Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the singer Debbie Harry. As a child, she used to dream that her mother was Marilyn Monroe and once said her early goals were to be noticed and to be famous. Well, she did that. Her group Blondie sold more than 30 million albums and had hit after hit. Heart of Glass, Call Me, Denis Denis, all powered up the charts. They had 7 number ones here and became the most successful American band ever in the UK. And her look, well, that was ultra cool. A striking beauty with platinum hair and a bit of a sneer. She used to hang out with the Ramones, Talking Heads, David Bowie and Iggy Pop. She was painted by Andy Warhol and feted the world over. "I think I really enjoyed the darker side of things," she says. "I wasn't content with being a white middle-class girl growing up and doing what was expected of her." So, Debbie Harry, you wanted to confound expectations or you just wanted to explore a different sort of life? Which was it?
I think I knew that there was more to life than what I grew up with and had a natural inclination for extremes. You know, my dad used to always say to me, "You're up here or you're down there, you know, you must level out." I don't think that I had, extreme mood swings or that kind of thing, but I have a lot of sensitivity and I appreciated going there.
And so here you are still performing. I'm wondering, you know, sometimes when people have explored the highs and the lows, there reaches a point where they think, no, they want to close the door on that life, you know, that ups and downs and on stage and the applause and then alone in the dressing room. You still enjoy exploring it, do you?
Well, I think that, you know, after all this time, I enjoy it more than ever. And
why is that?
I appreciate it probably more.
Right. Can you tell me why? Why do you think you
enjoy
it?
Because I feel that I'm better at it. I guess I just get more out of it, you know, and I keep learning things. I mean, what more could you ask for in a job?
I have to tell you, it is quite a strange sensation to be sitting opposite an icon.
Huh.
That's an odd thing, because there you were through all of the years that I was growing up. I think I probably wasted a good 10 years wanting to be Debbie Harry. And here is Debbie Harry, and you look, I mean, you are an astonishingly beautiful woman. I mean, you're beautifully dressed today. Can you describe, given that we don't have pictures to go with this, what you're wearing today?
Oh, I'm wearing a pair of strange tights that are striped, black and white stripes on the thighs and then black, solid black on the calves, and a sheer black top with little embroidered flowers, and then an over blouse that has sort of paisley things swimming on it.
What about as you, unbelievably are in your mid-60s now, do you have any problem with aging? You know, when you're a real beauty and you age, it can throw up conflicts.
Oh, yeah.
For women, right?
Sure. It's hard. I mean, because regardless of, you know, what I say about trying to be better at what I do, I rely on looks a lot, you know. And, you know, I mean, women's calling cards, unfortunately, are based on their looks many, many times. As far as aging goes, it's, you know, it's rough. I try my best now, you know. I really am healthy and I exercise like a fiend and, you know, do all that stuff that, you know, recovered drug addicts do. But I guess I appreciate life more, you know. I have a better perspective and I'm glad that I've had all the sort of radical experiences in my life, you know, that suits me.
Okay, do you still get shouts from truck drivers as they go past?
Hopefully.
I bet you do. Okay, it's time for some
music. A lot of times I have to stop them in the road, you know.
It's time for some music now then, Debbie Harry. What are we going to start with today? What's the first disc we're going to hear?
We're going to hear Heavy Cross by The Gossip.
Tell me why you've chosen this.
I love Beth's voice. In a record, it's different because they've done, you know, overdubs and more tracks. But live, they opened for us at a festival, just the two musicians and Beth, you know, it was fantastic, fantastic.
It's a cruel, cruel world to face on your own. A heavy cross to carry alone. The lights are on, but everyone's gone and it's cruel. It's a funny way to make ends meet when the lights are out on every street. It feels alright, but never complete without you.
That was The Gossip and Heavy Cross. Thinking there about a woman like Beth Ditto and before her, Courtney Love and Madonna, the reason that those people existed was, of course, because you had existed as the first woman to front a band very differently, I think. You weren't that, you know, you weren't the simpering singer in the silk dress and the high heels playing nice. Was that a very deliberate persona?
In a way, I think it was a sign of the times. I don't really claim that, you know, I invented it. It just sort of evolved. We had burned our bras and, you know, it just went on from there. I felt that, you know, women should not portray themselves as victims. We were counterculture of the period. I guess it was just, you know, the right time, the right place, the right thing, you know.
That very striking album cover of Parallel Lines, I think it sell about 10 million copies, Parallel Lines, and it's you standing in front of the band, and the band notably is smiling in a sort of sweet, cute photo call way, and there are you not smiling.
Well, I'll tell you what happened with that. We had a manager at the time who we were sort of at war with, and I really, you know, had a lot of problems with on a personal level. And he chose that picture.
Right.
Because he was pissed off at me. Because there was a lot of other shots where I was smiling, but he chose that one.
And when you first made it in the UK, I remember watching you on Top of the Pops, as a lot of people will. I think it was the end of the 70s, 79. And did you feel, when you were on stage, I mean, you always seemed incredibly confident on stage. Were you always a very confident, open person off stage as well?
I think I had the confidence of doing, you know, what I wanted to do. I don't know if I was completely confident about being a performer. Sometimes facing an audience is not easy. And I think that we were sort of thrown into a lot of situations that maybe we weren't especially ready for. But are you ever ready? I mean...
Let's have some music then. Next, Debbie Harry, your second disc today. Tell us what it is and why you've chosen it.
Well, I've chosen Nina Simone doing Strange Fruit. You know, she came through the 60s and lived through the 50s and all that. So she was a woman who really knew about that. And musically, why I chose it was because I really love her left hand. And the way she plays. And I've always felt that, you know, the way that she plays piano and the way that she sings are really, I don't want to use the word, but I have to, integrate it.
7 feet barren, strange fruit, blood on the leaves. And blood at the roots.
That was Nina Simone and Strange Fruit. So let's go back then, Debbie Harry. You were born in 1945 in Florida, but you were adopted when you were just a few months old and brought up in New Jersey. What are your memories of those early years?
Oh, they were great. You know, I was always allowed to roam around and I had a lot of freedom. It was good.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
I did. After a while, I had a baby sister when I was about six and a half.
Oh, okay. So you had quite a long time on your own.
Yeah.
With your parents.
Yes, I got good and spoiled, and it's nice.
How did you feel when she came along then?
I guess I was a little bit worried, you know, but then I became fascinated with her, and, you know, she was such a funny little thing.
And what were your parents like? Were they strict or...
Well, I think they felt that since I was somebody else, you know, I wasn't theirs. And also the first child, you know, they had to be really good parents.
Okay.
You know how that is. I think by the time my sister came along, they were a little bit more relaxed.
I read somewhere that you said, and you were being asked about being adopted, and you said that, you know, it wasn't until later that you realised, I think your words were, that I had been left with a core of fear and vulnerability that I couldn't identify.
Yeah.
Right. So you think that came from...
I think that comes from separation.
Right.
With my mother, and I was with my mother for a while, my natural mother, and I think that that was just one of those things that's an animal thing.
Yeah. And so did you ever try to trace your own mother and sort of work that out and talk to her about the whys?
I did look her up, and I think she was quite old at the time. So I think that she had made a resolution within herself that, you know, let the past lie. I don't think she really wanted to. And at that point, I really didn't need that information. I was already successful with Blondie. It wasn't like I was searching or desperate or anything like that.
And so your parents who brought you up, what did they want for you? Did you have to get good marks in school? Did you have to be a neat girl, a well-behaved girl?
Of course.
All of the above.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think that they really knew jack about, you know, the music business. Because of that, you know, they were sort of worried that, you know, I was going to feel, you know, disillusioned and crushed and everything. And, you know, quite possibly I would have. But my mother, I think, always envisioned me having a life very similar to hers, you know, marriage and family.
And they were quite a religious family, were they? I mean, it was church going and all of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Did you sing in the choir?
I did.
Right.
Of course.
Were you picked out for solos? Were you told?
Sometimes, yeah.
Yeah. So early on, I mean, you have, it's easy amid all the kind of image and the hits to forget about
where it
your
comes
voice.
From.
Yes, yeah. To forget that you have this voice. But you had a good voice from early on, did you?
Yes, I did have the ability to carry a tune and hear. You know, I had good ears.
And who were you listening to then in the 50s and 60s, early 60s?
Oh, I guess everything that was on the radio, mostly radio. I had my head practically in the speaker. The speaker was about this big. That's right, in there, listening to this music.
Were you a beautiful little girl? I imagine you must have been.
I think I went through good stages and bad stages, hideous stages, actually.
What were the most hideous? Give us some comfort. Ever have a perm?
Oh, I did. A home perm that really went bad. Really went bad. I had a fro long before it was the right thing to do.
That is some comfort, actually, somehow. The idea of you with a really bad perm makes us all feel a bit better. Okay, we're on disc number three then. Tell us what we're going to hear.
We're going to hear Merrymaking at My Place, Calvin Harris. It just moves along. It's a great feeling, dancing or driving or whatever. It's nice.
Into my house, entering the back of my house, welcoming you into my house. Come into my house.
That was Calvin Harris and Merrymaking. Definitely, he's whopping up a good time there. You like a good time, do you, Debbie Harry? You still like a good time?
Yeah, sure. We all want to go to Calvin's and dance around and have a good time.
Yeah, you know, the lyrics are pretty obvious. They're merrymaking, drug taking, you know, happy times at my place. Are you still, is that still part of your life?
Or? Am I still imbibing? No.
Yes.
No.
Never?
No. No, no, no. I've run the gamut.
Right.
I've done my thing with that.
Okay.
Yeah.
You enjoyed it, I presume. I mean, that's the thing that people never really talk about once they stop taking drugs, is actually they had a lot of happy times.
Well, yeah, I think so. I mean, it's carefree or careless or whatever. For me, it turned into not so much fun, you know, which I think, you know, for most people it does. It just wears thin.
Yeah. I want to talk to you about New York then. Of course, you being brought up, as we know, in New Jersey. New York, only a matter of a few miles away, really, but it must have seemed, you know, like almost like the promised land. When did you start going to New York as a young girl?
Very young, you know, 4 or 5 years old. My grandmother and my mother would take me in into the city to either go shopping or to go to the Christmas show or the Easter show, just to sort of be a tourist.
Right. And when you were a teenager, were you allowed to go by yourself into the city?
I wasn't really allowed to, but I did.
Conjure up a day for me. How would you spend the afternoon?
Well, I would just walk around, you know, just get the vibe, just check out different neighborhoods. The Village was very interesting to me, with the coffee shops and the beats and everything. You know, I knew that there were artists there. I knew that that's really what I wanted to be.
And did you start to rebel as a teenager at home? Did you start to not get on with your parents?
I think I was a typical teenager in many respects, you know, wanting to fly, you know, spread my wings.
So what did you do? How would you, apart from going into the city when you weren't supposed to, what kind of things would you get up
to? Mostly it was about style for me. I don't think that I was ever truly, totally, obnoxiously disobedient or disrespectful to my parents. You know, I liked them as people, but I certainly went, you know, for my own look.
And what would it have been? Describe it.
I think my mother would have had me in little sort of Peter Pan collars and pleated skirts, and I went for black sheaths and, you know, big hair and white lipstick, you know, as extreme and the opposite as I could possibly get.
Let's have some more music then, Debbie Harry. What are we going to hear next?
We're going to hear White Light, White Heat by Lou Reed, and I believe it's the Velvet Underground.
And why have you chosen this one?
I don't know. I love Lou Reed and love the Velvet Underground. And I think it was one of the first bands that I saw in New York. I was completely flabbergasted and knocked out by it. And actually, Nico was singing with them that night, and Andy Warhol had designed the stage set and the colors. And I think he was responsible for the lights, too. And it was just an incredible show and just brings back good memories.
That was The Velvet Underground and White Light, White Heat. So tell me, Debbie Harry, when did you feel that your life went from being lived in a kind of suburban New Jersey black and white to being lived in New York Technicolor?
I got a job in the first head shop on the Lower East Side.
What was that for?
Well, what was that? That was for, you know, people that smoked pot.
Oh, right.
And took acid.
Okay.
I don't think that I was actually doing that at that time, but Dayglow, you know, posters and T-shirts and, you know, like the usual crap that people sell now.
So that was sort of, was that when you started to think, yeah, it feels like the shoes fit? This is kind of, I like the counterculture. I like the darker side of life.
I don't know if I really considered it the darker side of life. I felt like it was part of what was going on. It was pretty fun, you know. There was bands everywhere and, you know, colorful clothing, and it just suited me.
And why did you...
I fit right in.
Yeah, I bet. And why was it music rather than acting? Did you ever have a go at acting? Did you have any
Not
capacity?
Seriously, no. But right. I fell into music. That was it. It sort of stayed on my mind that I really wanted to pursue this.
Tell me about the time that I saw you say in a documentary that you saw Chris Stein from the audience. Is that right? You were up on stage.
Yeah, I was on stage doing a little trio thing called the Stilettos. And Chris was in the audience. And I felt like I could really deliver.
Did you talk to him that night? Or you just...
Yes.
Yes, you
yes,
did.
I did. I met him afterwards. And, you know, he was very sweet, nice guy.
Now, I never had the pleasure of going to the club CBGB's, so I need you to describe it to me. What was it like? What would I have found?
It was a biker bar to start with.
Okay.
And it was pretty funky. you could go there and act up a little bit and not be thrown out, you know. You'd have to act up a lot, get thrown out.
And so it was full of, as I understand it, you know, Talking Heads was there, and the Ramones, those kind of, was it all bands watching other bands, really?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That, quite a tough audience, I'm thinking, then, to play to other bands.
Perhaps. I think at that particular time, there was no money involved. Nobody was interested in us. It was a clubhouse, really, very insulated and isolated. And Chris and I both have sort of said, you know, reflecting on that, that it was kind of ideal, you know, to get your shit together and, you know, to have that period of not being exposed.
Was there ever a time when you thought, you know, here I am, I'm 30 now, and I really need to shake this up and kind of get a proper job?
No, I was an idiot, and I had no concept of... I felt, I wish that I was younger, but I don't know. I was one of those idiots who thought they were going to live forever.
Let's have some music now then, Debbie Harry. What are we going to hear next?
Oh, we're going to hear When I Grow Up by Fever Ray.
Why have you chosen this particularly?
I don't know. I think the good songwriter, nice lyrical ideas.
So that was Fever Ray and When I Grow Up. So, Debbie Harry, Blondie explodes and people start to really buy your records. And you pulled off that pretty rare trick of being at once entirely commercially successful and at the same time being credible and cool. Pretty clever stuff, really.
I think people were more broad-minded in those days. I mean, you know, we wanted to reach people. I wanted to entertain people.
Did you want to be a star?
Yeah. I mean, I always said that, you know, I wanted to be a movie star, basically. You know, it seemed like, well, gee, that must be great, you know, to be a star, you know.
And what about your look then? I mean, David LaChapelle, the photographer, called you the definition of cool.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he did.
Oh, thanks, Dave.
And he should know.
Clearly, I mean, we had called it Blondie. I had to have the blonde hair. And, you know, I worked in a salon for a while, so, I mean, bleach was easily available.
Did you bleach your own hair? Is it true that...
Oh, yeah, then later on I completely burnt it off my head, but, you know, I'm kidding. I mean, I think I've enjoyed, you know, a certain freedom. As I said, you know, I grew up in a different time and there was, you know, more freedom for making bad mistakes, perhaps.
Well, yeah, that's very interesting that you had this time for everything to kind of percolate through, that you were performing to people, as you say, you weren't talent spotted. There was nobody saying, you know, I'll get you an endorsement, or, you know, you were just doing your own thing.
I like audiences. I remember one especially really, really fun one was in New Orleans. It was at this club, and I had on this dress that was made of razor blades, double-edged.
You really do like to live on the edge, don't you? Yeah.
Well, you know, it was beautiful. I looked like a snake skin, you know, and it moved, and it was really pretty. I was up on stage and doing this great set, and everybody was out of their minds and, you know, celebrating, and the hands were reaching out of the audience and running down my razor blade dress. And I was sort of thinking, oh, my God, oh, my God. And then the lights went out and the sound went off. The electricity went off. But the hands were still, you know, caressing my dress and going up and down my legs. And it was just this great moment, you know. And then the lights and the music came back on and I went back into the song. And it was just a really exciting moment. Very visual.
I can see it now, almost.
Yeah.
Let's have some more music then, Debbie Harry. Tell us what we're going to hear next.
I think we're going to hear something from 8 and a Half, a film by Federico Fellini. The music is from Nino Rota, who I've always liked. A lot of these songs are very visual to me, and I like that.
La Passerella by Nino Rota from the Federico Fellini film 8 and a Half. So, Debbie Harry, I think I said in the introduction that you sold more than 30 million albums. You know, that's a lot of music to shift. Was there a point, though, that you were told that you didn't have the amount in the bank that one might imagine a group that has sold 30 million albums would have?
No, I don't think so. I think that we've always felt that we didn't get compensated according to how many things that we sold.
Right.
We had a very bad experience with a business manager who, unfortunately, you know, convinced us that instead of paying taxes, taking money and investing it in something that, you know, was a really the right thing to do. And so we followed his advice, and it was totally the wrong thing to do.
Right.
So it just put us in tax hell for a long time.
Okay.
And so that was really the bad part.
I see. So this was like a legitimate tax avoidance scheme that turned out to be a very bad investment, really.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And so when did the walls come crashing down? When did you think, well, you know, we got to... I mean, I also read that you had to sell a beautiful uptown townhouse and all the things.
Oh, yeah, that was a... I guess it was in about 83 or 84, right. Something like that. 82 is when the band broke up. I don't know, it's in that, you know, early 80s period. God, everything just collapsed. Just collapsed. We had no management, we had no label. Chris got very sick. It just, everything collapsed.
Right. And, you know, people have said, well, Debbie Harry gave up her career to look after Chris Stein.
I know, it's so awful, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't sound awful. It sounds quite selfless.
That's what I mean. I'm not really totally like that. I really felt like Chris and I were like a team, and I really had no inclination to go on. I really didn't.
Right.
I just didn't envision myself as a solo artist. I never really wanted to be a solo artist, actually. I always wanted to be in a band. I always did, yeah.
And obviously, when you find out that your partner is so desperately ill, that is a time of intense emotion. You thought you were going to lose him at one point. You thought that he wouldn't survive this illness?
Well, yeah, that's what I was told. I was told that it was terminal and there was no cure for it, so that was kind of awful. But that was bad information.
Right. And yeah. How long did it take Chris Stein to recover?
Quite a while, yeah. I think that his brain was always working. I mean, we still had some laughs and stuff like that. It wasn't completely horrible. I mean, it was just very, very hard physically.
Let's have some more music, Debbie Harry, then. We're on disc number 7. What are we going to hear?
We're going to hear Talk to Me from Peaches, whom I also think is a terrific entertainer, very talented person, and greatly overlooked.
Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? I'm standing here alone. I know you'll never phone. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? Come say it to my face so we can leave this place. Why don't you talk to me?
That was Peaches and Talk to Me. It's difficult looking at you today to think that you went through what you yourself dubbed the ice cream years.
Oh.
Because you look beyond fabulous today.
Oh, thanks so much.
And there's a time when you were snapped in one of those supermarket tabloid things. I think you were probably doing your shopping.
Yeah.
And you didn't look the way a superstar is supposed to look, even when they're doing their shopping.
Yeah, no, that was when Chris was in hospital and, you know, I was out buying some ice cream.
Okay.
It was easy for him to swallow. And, of course, very easy for me to swallow.
I mean, you said, you know, as we know, he survived his illness. Your relationship didn't survive. And you said of that time, I'm quoting here, I was tired and disillusioned, burnt out. Everything just seemed to crack and fall apart. You must be a very, very resilient woman, because here you sit today, not only looking fabulous, but more importantly, you know, still performing and entirely coherent and through all the drug stuff that went on. You're very resilient.
I guess so.
Yeah.
Who knew?
You didn't know, did you? You didn't know you were capable of that.
I guess I sort of knew, you know. I mean, I don't know.
Is it right that you are godmother now to Chris Stein's... Is it to both his children?
Yeah, right. Just two girls.
So there is a kind of, in a way, a sort of happy ending to all of those of us who are Blondie fans who kind of...
Oh, sure.
Yes.
Yeah, I think, you know, surviving is a happy ending. And, I mean, what an unpredictable, you know, way things happen. I mean, it's fantastic. I don't know what to say. I seem to have a lot of godchildren. People think that I'm a good godmother, but, you know, I'm totally not religious.
Yeah, well, you're supposed to, I think you kind of oversee their moral development.
Ah, well, they're screwed. I would never kill anybody, except maybe in self-defense, but, you know.
Aside from that, anything's possible. Okay. You've said that you've got lots of godchildren. Are you sorry you don't have children of your own?
Sometimes. I guess it never struck me as being part of survival. And I think for many people it is. It's a way of surviving.
I'm going to cast you away then, Debbie Harry, as you know. You're going to this island all on all on your own, with, of course, your music.
I demand to know if I'm going to have solar-powered batteries for my equipment.
No, you're not, I'm afraid. It's a little wind-up gramophone we give you.
Oh, that's it's it. A wind-up. Well, then that works.
How are you going to cope on your own, do you think?
Gee, I don't know. I can't imagine being in a situation where there was really no one to talk to except myself. Oh, my God.
Let's have some comfort then with the final piece of music today, Debbie Harry. What's your eighth disc today?
Ah, this is the music by Mahler from Death in Venice, which I find so moving and so beautiful. Just incredible. Just incredible.
That was the opening of the fourth movement of Mahler's Symphony No. 5, performed by the Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Sir Simon Rattle. So, Debbie, I'm going to give you the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. You get three books, though. You can take one of your own. What are you going to take?
The Bible?
It's up to you. You can do what you want with
it.
Oh,
I see.
Okay.
Well, there are a lot of stories in there. I can have another book.
Yeah.
That's horrible. I don't know if I can choose.
This is your only opportunity. You're going to really be annoyed if you don't bother to take a third
one. Can I take, like, Dostoevsky or something?
One book by Dostoevsky.
That's
I will allow
awful.
You. It is awful.
Jeez.
You're going to have to give us one single book, Debbie Harry. I hate being this cruel to you.
Well, War and Peace is fat, isn't it?
It is. It's certainly a big book.
Okay, let's take that.
Okay, War and Peace is yours, along with the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare. And what a happy time you'll have.
Whoa.
And a luxury, too. You can have something just to make life a little more easy, a bit more bearable on this island. what would your luxury be?
Well, I did say pen and paper, but maybe it should be colours and paper.
Okay, so like paints or gouache or something to make it, right?
Yeah, yeah, that would be fun.
Okay, I'll give you an endless supply of paper and paints to paint pictures. And if you had to choose just one of these eight tracks, if the waves were to threaten to wash away the discs, which one? It gets worse. Which one would you run to save? You're glad you came.
Oh, no. I mean, do I get the full-length version of these things, or do I only get the two-minute version?
No, you do. You get.
Well,
the
I have to take one of the longer pieces, like either from Nina Rota or Mahler. Depends on whether I want to be sad or happy. I think maybe I would take the Mahler.
Okay.
Because I can sing all the rest.
Lovely. It's yours then. Debbie Harry, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.